come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love him.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. I'm your host, Bill Frank. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business and politics. As we get closer to the election, these two subjects dominate the conversation. Each of my guests will discuss either business or politics or both. My next guest has examined the financial crisis of 2007-2008 from a different perspective. He's extracted the governance and management lessons learned from the crisis and distilled them in his new book, Why Some Firms Thrive While Others Fail. Thomas Stanton is a Washington, D.C. attorney and a fellow of the Center for Study of American Government at Johns Hopkins University. He was a senior investigator for the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that examined the causes of the financial meltdown of 2007-2008. Tom earned his B.A. degree from the University of California at Davis, his master's from Yale University, and his Juris Doctorate from Harvard Law School. His latest book is titled Why Some Firms Thrive While Others Fail, Governance and Management Lessons from the Crisis. Joining us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm very fine. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for being our guest on the show. Now, I just want to dive into it because as a senior investigator for the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, you had the opportunity to see the root causes of the financial crisis firsthand. So based on what you observed, what differentiated successful companies from unsuccessful firms during that turbulent period?
We interviewed CEOs. I personally interviewed five of both successful and unsuccessful firms, risk officers, traders, bankers, regulators, policymakers. So we really had a chance to try to understand the answer to that question. And the bottom line, I think, revolves around the role of the CEO and the role of powerful people within the company, people that are making a lot of money. Mm. And the firms that succeeded had CEOs and managers that would constantly listen to feedback. They would constantly ask, how am I doing? What's going on here? Try to understand it. The firms that failed had CEOs that basically said, this is what we're going to do. They took positions. They didn't listen to feedback from their regulators or from their managers or from their risk officers, and they drove their companies off the cliff.
Well, now, Tom, listening to feedback and acting on it are two different things. You differentiate in the book, you talk about something called constructive dialogue, which is what you're just referring to there, that feedback. But first of all, you know, once you hear the constructive dialogue, you still have to do something with it. You have to both process it and then act on it. So yep. What did the successful managers and the successful CEOs do differently when it came to processing and acting?
When you get a signal that something may not be right, somebody says something, gives you feedback, the risk officer comes up and says, we've got a problem. What you need to do is investigate. In other words, the person sounding the alarm may not be right, but it's a signal, and you've got to find out what's going on. So at J.P. Morgan Chase, which has had its trouble since, and we can talk about that, but during the crisis was really effective, the retail side of the company saw that delinquencies were going up on mortgages they were servicing. They reported that up to the management team. The management team had a huge discussion about it. What's really going on here? And then instructions went down to the investment banking side of the company. Let's get rid of our exposure to subprime mortgages. So what you need to do is respond to the signal by asking what's going on here. That's the first step.
All right. My guest is Tom Stanton. His book is Why Some Firms Thrive While Others Fail. Tom, I found it interesting in your observations and your discussion about this topic that the issue of ethics really didn't come up very much. Talk to us about ethics. How does that fit into your analysis of the successful and unsuccessful firms?
Well, I sort of view ethics as a fundamental precondition. The trouble is that if you look at the way the laws have been written, there were relatively few violations of laws by people who destroyed their companies. And that relates then back to ethics, because we would interview people, companies that survived and companies that didn't, and they would say, we did not violate the law. We were ethical. It's a principle of the free market system that within the realm of the law, we can go for broke. And they did. And the problem was that a lot of these people, they may not have been selling mortgages directly to homeowners that shouldn't have gotten those mortgages, but they were providing the investment funds for the people that did sell those mortgages.
Well, it's a very interesting point that you bring up here, Tom, because you mentioned that thin line between legal and illegal activity and that ethics is a given. However, when you look at the financial crisis, people who are on the outside looking in, lay people, if you will, they're looking and saying, well, wait a minute. You know, during the meltdown of the savings and loan boom in the 1980s, there were trials and there were convictions of CEOs that did things incorrectly and brought the country at that time to its knees. They're looking at this meltdown and saying, well, wait a minute. We haven't seen one single arrest here. We haven't seen, and you mentioned the fact that they really didn't do anything illegal. Talk to us in a little bit more depth, because people are anxious, want to know why there weren't more arrests made, why there hasn't been more trials for these executives. Leo Mazzillo here in our own Ventura County comes to mind as an example.
Angela Mazzillo is a really interesting case. On the one hand, he was telling us, people, you got to go for market share. We want 30% market share. On the other hand, he was sending people emails saying, these are really risky mortgages. We shouldn't be in this business. But, of course, when his managers got the word, we've got to increase market share, that was the goal they were going after. It's a really hard problem. With the S&L crisis, you had a two-step process where the S&Ls first lost all of their value, and then they went out and they bet the bank, which is what they call it, went out and took huge risks, and very often violated the law. Here, the financial sector has given order of magnitude $500 million with a B to the political process in each of the election cycles, that's each of the two-year cycles. That's a lot of money, and that gets you laws that may not have the kind of teeth you want, and for sure it gets you regulators that may not have the kind of strength you want. So we're dealing with a whole different problem. That's what I tried to address in my chapter on regulation and supervision, that we need to change the way the supervisors work. We need to restore a balance of power between the regulated companies and the regulators. Everybody acts as if the regulators have all this authority. Well, the regulators are really scared. I mean, take Countrywide. In 2007, Countrywide decided they didn't like their regulator, and under the law, they could simply shift charters and go someplace else. And we haven't really solved that problem. So as long as a regulator fears if this regulated bank is just going to go to a more congenial regulator if I push too hard, that's a real limit on what they can do.
That is a very much a limit. My guest is Tom Stanton, author of the book, Why Some Firms Thrive While Others Fail, Governance and Management Lessons from the Crisis. I want to stay on this whole issue of the regulators, if we can, for just a minute, Tom, and delve into this a little bit more. Yes, the regulators are a little bit gun-shy. Yes, companies can change regulators. But is this really a case of lax regulation, or is it more of a case of insufficient number of regulators? And I'm going to talk about the SEC. They were warned several times about Bernie Madoff, for instance, before they ever acted on it. And it was only because Bernie Madoff turned himself in that we found out about his Ponzi scheme.
You're absolutely right. And there were warnings for years beforehand. There's no justification for it. Clearly the agency, actually one of my students at Johns Hopkins just wrote a superb thesis on the SEC, and they were slowly but surely getting captured, getting bottled up. They didn't have the amount of staff they needed. They didn't have the strength. They didn't have the willpower to go out and do their job in a serious way. And that has been tremendously expensive, not only in the Madoff case, but if you look, they were supervising the five biggest investment banks, and we've lost three of those five.
Yes, we have.
Bear, Lehman, and Merrill Lynch.
Very tragic. My guest is Tom Stanton. So, Tom, from your perspective, I want to do a little compare and contrast, if we can, with some of the companies in the financial crisis. And I'm just going to call out a couple. We've mentioned it several times. We're going to beat up on them again because they are a Ventura County company. Countrywide Financial versus Wells Fargo. Both were in the mortgage business. Both had very, very different outcomes. Compare and contrast those two companies, if you will.
I would be delighted because it's a really interesting contrast. As I mentioned, Angelo Mozilo and Countrywide were going for market share, no holds barred. They didn't have a calculus of risk versus reward to figure out what they should be doing. When we interviewed the CEO at Wells, and we also interviewed the head of the Wells mortgage operations, the head of Wells mortgage operations showed me a chart and said, yes, we were doing subprime, but we weren't doing the most risky subprime. And here's the market share we lost in 05, 06, 07 because we weren't willing to play that game. And in the end, the successful firms lost market share, weren't making the profits of their more active competitors, but a lot of those competitors aren't around anymore.
That is true. All right, another compare and contrast. Let's compare Washington Mutual versus J.P. Morgan Chase. And coming out of the whole financial debacle, Jamie Dimon there for a while was considered the golden boy, the fair-haired child of bank presidents. He was considered the best. So talk to us about Washington Mutual versus J.P. Morgan Chase.
Well, among other things, Jamie Dimon had a concept, what he called fortress balance sheet. Keep more capital on your books than the regulators require, because we're in a cyclical business, and when things turn down, you need to be able to take the hit. And in fact, that mentality is what protected Jamie Dimon when their London office just took their $5.8 billion of losses, that they had a strong balance sheet. Washington Mutual, once again, was going for market share, was driving forward. We examined the performance criteria for their risk officer, and the number one criterion for the risk officer was what kind of revenues the company's producing. That's not a risk officer's job, but they were basically incentivizing everybody in the company to go for broke. There's a second difference. J.P. Morgan Chase insists on putting all their information onto a common platform. These companies are huge. I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase now is more than $2 trillion. These are huge companies, and WAMU basically grew by acquisition, and they never had a picture of the risks or even the activities across their whole organization. It was just unmanageable, or at least unmanaged.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. My guest is Tom Stanton. But Tom, I want to continue on with J.P. Morgan Chase if we can, and you brought up the London whale trade. Yes, the fortress balance sheet did protect them from the $4 to $6 billion loss that they took on that particular trade, but it did call into question this whole idea of the organization just being too big for one person to manage it. And one of your criteria for failure is the inability to manage an integrated organization. Has J.P. Morgan just gotten too big?
There are two answers to that. I mean, the first answer is, it looks to me that J.P. Morgan got too complacent. They sailed through the crisis. They thought everything is great. We are the best thing since beer in a bottle. And in the end, their risk system, their risk management system, simply got lax and simply wasn't checking out what they should have been checking out. Also, J.P. Morgan Chase seems to have lost their ability to take feedback. Their news accounts, the regulators were asking questions. What are the parameters on these risk models you've got for your London office? And J.P. Morgan Chase was basically stiffing them and not giving them the information. That's hubris, that's arrogance, and that's got to go away. And my hunch is that the company, having taken its losses, will be chastened and will be a lot more open at this point. But that's a critical issue. Now, are they too big to manage? Well, I spend four pages in my book giving the table of organization of AIG, with another big company that failed, and they're a lot smaller than J.P. Morgan Chase. And the four pages have really tiny print on them. These organizations are getting huge, and it's getting harder and harder to manage them. Not only are they complicated in a whole bunch of different countries, hundreds of thousands of employees, but they're doing all sorts of different things. And it's becoming increasingly hard, I wouldn't say one person, but for a management team to manage that kind of organization. And only the best have shown the ability to do it.
My guest is Tom Stanton, author of the book, Why Some Firms Thrive While Others Fail. So it brings us to one of the interesting paradoxes of the regulation coming out of the financial crisis. The Dodd-Frank bill was passed in order to prevent banks to be too big to fail. That was the idea, the intent behind it. However, if you look underneath the hood and look at the numbers, prior to Dodd-Frank, you had assets in the big banks that were roughly 55% of total bank assets were combined in the big banks. After the Dodd-Frank bill was passed, that number actually increased to 70% of total bank assets were under the management or under the control of the big banks. It seems that in a perverse twist of fate, that the big got bigger, and instead of being trying to resist being too big to fail, they've actually moved towards being even bigger to fail. Your comments on that.
Dodd-Frank, well, first of all, you're right on. Dodd-Frank did contribute a number of improvements. But if you start talking to academics, to people who have studied Dodd-Frank, have studied the financial system, there is a whole undercurrent of people, and we meet sort of regularly, you know, one by one. And when you listen, all of us say, Dodd-Frank imposed a lot of burdens on the industry, but in the end has not protected us adequately against the possibility of another financial crisis. So I think you're spot on.
My guest is Tom Stanton. Tom, what do you want readers to take away from your book, Why Some Firms Thrive and Others Fail?
The core message, I spoke this morning with a board of directors of a large financial group. The core message is, boards of directors have got to work with the CEO and provide active oversight and active feedback, and they better hire CEOs that are ready to listen. Arrogance kills in this business. And the second message I have is one going back to your questions about regulators, that we want to create a win-win constructive dialogue between regulators and the regulated companies. I mean a constructive tension, not that the regulator's captured, but that the company listens to feedback. These companies are so big and so complex, they should accept feedback wherever they can get it. And that's a lot better than the lose-lose we've got now, where regulators are called in front of a congressional committee and absolutely hammered. Why didn't you pick up this risk or the next risk? And we had a whole series of these just in the last few months. And then the regulators go back to their offices and say, I'm going to go out and bring an enforcement action against somebody. And they may pick smaller issues, not the core issues, but they pick what they think they can win. And that's a lose-lose kind of situation. We're not improving oversight of the financial system with that.
We're not. My guest has been Tom Stanton. Tom, you've probably piqued the interest of a lot of our listeners who want to learn more about you, learn more about the book. Where would you direct them to go?
First of all, the book is on Amazon and other online booksellers. Also, I'm just creating a website, www.thomas-stanton.com. And if you're interested in academic writings along the lines of what we've both been chatting about, please visit the website.
That is great. Tom, it has been a delight. Thank you very much for being my guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, thanks a lot, Bill.